Hello, everybody. Welcome to Important Records. We are at Saki Records. It is a very lovely evening in Chicago, Illinois. What neighborhood is this? Not Logan Square. West, you liars. It is not West Logan Square. That is not a neighborhood. We're almost in a bad neighborhood, but enough whites are here to make it safe. Thanks to Saki Records for letting us do this here. We really appreciate it. This is a third installment of Important Records. It's one of my favorite shows we've ever done, and we're going to start with a brand new friend. I've known this guy for a very, very long time, actually longer than I've known all the people in the room, maybe put together. Ladies and gentlemen, please give him a warm round of applause for Emerson Dameron, everybody. Emerson!
Thank you, Brandon.
I can't play the song, I apologize.
That's okay.
I
just want to say one great thing about this clusterfuck economy is that if you go to fiverr.com, you can get a song recorded about yourself for $5, which I think is a great thing for any performer to come on stage to. The psychologist Carl Jung had a patient who was quoted as saying, "I wish I could tear this skin off. If I didn't have this stupid body, I'd be as pure outside as I feel inside." And another psychologist named Ernest Becker wrote a great book right before he died, which was called The Denial of Death. And in it, he writes, "We can conclude quite categorically that hypochondrias and phobias are focalizations of the terror of life and death by an animal who doesn't want to be one. No mistake, the turd is mankind's real threat." And that brings us in a roundabout fashion to the music of Swans. Swans has been around since the 80s. They've had a shifting lineup. The only constant has been a gentleman named Michael Girard, who has this incredibly deep bass singing voice, and you'll probably bust out laughing the first time you hear it. He's like the very tortured man's Barry White. And he was already pushing 30 by the time Swans did their first show. I think he'd lived in Los Angeles for a long time, which got him fascinated with new religious movements or cults. He'd spent time in an Israeli prison for selling drugs, and he had a pretty dark worldview way before he ever started this band. The early Swans started in New York around the same time that Sonic Youth did, when The Kitchen was still a thing and CBGB's was not selling hats yet. And the Trouser Press record guide from the 90s described Swans, I may be misquoting this, but I'm pretty sure they described Swans as Sonic Youth's retarded cousins. Basically, up through a certain point, every Swan song goes pretty much like this. And with that, you have pretty much the first half of the Swans catalog through the 80s. If you don't believe in hell, the early Swan stuff is a great alternative. That changed when a woman named Jarbo joined the band, who was Michael Girard's romantic partner and was from Atlanta, so she had kind of a southern accent, and brought this whole different angle. It was much more melodic. The songs started using strings and orchestral elements and synthesizers, and it was beyond prog. It was these big cinematic experiences. If you've never listened to Swans, I would recommend starting with Love of Life or White Light from the Mouth of Infinity, which were albums that were in that vein, and one of which we will get back to later. So at this, you know, Swans by the 90s had this heart and humanity in them, and Michael Gerard really developed as a lyricist with this clinical William S. Burroughs style of describing nightmarish scenarios. Their album Dreamland came out in 1995, and it has a weird billing. It's credited, the artist credit is M. Girard, and the title of the album technically is Swans Related Project Dreamland. And that's because Michael Girard and Jarbo were separated at this point, and we're about to find out why. First thing we hear on track one, side one, You See Through Me, is this very delicate guitar figure and a very high, simple piano figure. And then we start hearing a tape. The refrain in the background goes, You See Through Me, which keeps on going throughout as we listen to M and Jarbo having a major fight. Michael Girard is drunk and belligerent, and they're obviously separated, but still fighting about money, fighting about Michael Girard's drinking. Jarbo says, So the fact that I worry about you drinking too much is a bad thing, huh? Michael Girard says, It's your problem. No one cares about you. Figure out how to get the money. Drunk and angry is a good way to describe him. Let's say this. You don't make anything which you don't, Jarbo. I sure do pay income taxes. And it gets more and more brutal as the figures continue in the back. And the last thing we hear is, Do you love me at all, Michael? No. Click. The piano figure tapers off. And this discussion was taped, and Michael Girard decided to put it on the first track of his solo album to set the tone. all the darkness aside, it's nice that he got a little time on his own to experiment. Whereas Swans was very loud and kind of overwhelming, this album is noisy. It's kind of skirts the line between noise and music. We have tape loops, all kinds of sound effects, what sounds like a garbage truck picking up huge garbage bags full of glass bottles. We have these kind of grinding, fuzzy organs, and at one point, there's what sounds like, and I swear I think this is the best way to describe it, it sounds like the voice of the character Nell from the film of the same name. And by track three, side one, we're starting to get into these motifs that establish the themes. I See Them All Lined Up is the name of the song. Swans recorded it several other times. One version was in German, and it's awesome. This is very minimal, and pretty much all we get in the way of backdrop is a synthesizer going dow, 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 and a little cymbal hook going tss, tss, tss. And that's about it. And over this, we get lyrics such as, Their skin is hanging off in sheets. Their rooms are powdered with white salt. I hear my name as it spills out. There's a power that comes from watching other people suffer, and that seems to be what this song is about. I taste the smell of burning hair. And that's just ridiculously goth, which I don't know if it was an epithet in the 90s. I don't think it exists at all anymore. But the point is that we've established the themes, which are torture, bodily disgust, and extreme pessimism, which continue throughout the record. Later on, he constructs these beautiful little motifs. Like, there's one scene where a sacred man and woman are being tortured, and they scream out the windows and into the Himalayas. The scream turns into a butterfly. The butterfly flies to Paris and lands on a street, and a character from the song crushes it with her high heel. When I had this album, I was living in the sticks in Western North Carolina, and I hadn't really been exposed to depressing French cinema, so this was magnifique. This kind of setting of the scene. This world is made of losers, but I want to be a winner. So I'll send my mind into the hard body of a rock star. And maybe then you'll fuck me, because 5 million people love me, and you want to suck my energy. Rimshot fart noise. Just a little aside, a pinch of context. I went to see Michael Girard perform in Atlanta in 1999. Somebody heckled him. He lashed out for a minute, and then he seemed to check himself. It's okay. I'll suck all of your dicks after the show. Moving along, one of my favorites is track 8, or what would be side 2, track 3, and it's called If You, with an ellipsis. And I imagine in this one that Girard is a lounge singer in a cavern, with some sort of pus running down the walls, naturally. And he kind of vamps through each line, and then on the last word, this gnashing organ comes on, and I imagine a spotlight comes on behind him to reveal a cast of extraordinarily creepy Muppets in the back. My body's just empty skin. Floating through tunneling space. Then we get a bunch of crashing noise and warped free jazz and the chorus, which is basically, it's all right, I don't care, it's all right. Which moves us into track number 9, side 2 number 4, which is called Why I Ate My Wife. The title says it all, really, but I'll give you some spoilers. She lied to him. He was troubled by troubling visions. They had physical contact, and he was grossed out by it. He felt her eyes in his, remembering, maybe seeing through him, so he ate the bitch. I can't remember the world, but I love you. I can't remember my name. You see through me. Which is, I'm guessing, is hard to do from the narrator's intestinal tract. The last song on the record is a special one. It's called Blind. It was not recorded for this album. It was a swan song with the full band. There was going to be on White Light from the Mouth of Infinity, but I guess they tabled it, ended up on this record. Would have made more sense on that one, but lyrically it makes a lot more sense here on Drainland, because this is the hangover anthem. Get your damn hands up. Let me see those tremors and busted capillaries. American Music Club has nothing on this song. They basically do P.T. Anderson soundtracks compared to this song by Girard. This is feeling shame for your very existence and feeling the full weight of age and knowing that everything's been lost, or at least acknowledging everything that's been forgotten, paths never to be walked again. This is knowing it all, knowing it's all bad, and having no answers. This is the intense self-loathing of the problem drinker. And I haven't had a drink in 6 months, but I kind of miss really relating to songs like this. Sometimes, I was never young, nothing has transpired. Life isn't just miserable now, it was always miserable. You were just too stupid to realize it. If you have a bad hangover, looking in the mirror is the worst thing that you could possibly do. And of course, the narrator of this song does it. And I guess this record was important to me because it was this full realization of the nastiness of the human condition, which, you know, our bodies are gross. They get grosser as we get old. We're sort of trapped and isolated inside of our skins. We have these very rich, huge symbolic lives that there's no guarantee that they're even real. The only like real gospel truth that we have left is that we're all going to die. And almost nobody can handle that without falling apart or seeking some kind of help. And maybe that's the heroic task of our lifetimes. I think it's the job of any artist, maybe our whole species, to find something beyond this. And Girard himself is quite sure that he's not up to it, which when I got this record and my parents were going through this bloodbath of a divorce and I was just now starting to think about all of these things, on all these crazy medications, kind of very confused. That made this important to me. Thanks. And now Jim Cooper will take the stage.
Well, thank you, Emerson, for that erudite introduction to the Swans. I have a confession to make that when he asked me to play this song tonight for you, ironically, this was my first Swan song. I had never spent any time... Thank you. Thank you very much. Had never spent any time with Swans, although, and in fact, had deliberately avoided them because my elder brother had been an enthusiastic aficionado since their inception in the 80s and has browbeat me for years how I should spend time with their records and how I should see them at, you know, any and all opportunity. So, and if he's listening to this now, I apologize, Andrew. And I love you very much. But our family life was intense enough without adding the intensity of these, as Emerson said, these torturous songs. Ironically, too, when Emerson asked me to play tonight, he happened to catch me on a really horrible weekend. So I listened to this song and was just like overcome with it. Like, this is me. Right now, I was hungover and a little drunk when I was listening to it. I was having a horrible time with my girlfriend, whom I love, who's here tonight too. But it hit me in the perfect space, and I was able to see the brilliance in his very unvarnished sort of lyrical approach. So. I apologize ahead of time. I pulled this arrangement straight out of my ass yesterday, so it will be a little sloppy, but I'll do what I can. And thank you for inviting me to be here. This is great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Some of us are weak, and some endure. Some people live their lives with a violence that's pure and clean. But I saw a man cry once, down on his knees, in the corner of a darkened cell. And his pain meant nothing to me. I was younger then, and young men never die. When I walked out in the sun, I was strong, clear-minded, and blind. Don't say a prayer for anyone, it doesn't do any good. Please don't ask me questions, it'd just be misunderstood. And if you could step inside me, you'd feel what hatred brings. And if you saw with my eyes, you'd see what self-deception means. I was younger once, and I created a lie. Though my body was strong, I was self-deluded, confident, and blind. Now show some pity for the weak of will, because when we're drinking, we can never be filled. Show some understanding for a lonely fool, because when we're drinking, we are out of control. I was never young, nothing has transpired. When I look in the mirror, I feel dead, I feel cold, I am blind.
Store today, and a goes fast. Think of the past. And suddenly everything has changed. And it goes fast. And think of the past. And suddenly everything has changed.
In the late winter, early spring of 1994, my partner and I, along with two other couples, decided to go on spring break. This was then, and maybe still is, a thing. High schools give kids like a week off in March or April, and oftentimes they travel unsupervised with their friends to somewhere sunny so that they can get alcohol poisoning together. My pals were a little mellower and way more broke, so we hopped in Heather, that was my girlfriend's name, we hopped in Heather's car and drove to Cleveland, Ohio for spring break 1994. And if I were a more compelling storyteller, I would pause here and do that thing, that devil's horns thing, with my hands and say, Cleveland, Ohio, spring break 1994, in a funny voice. We decided we were all going to pitch in together for a motel for a few nights. We had made this plan. We'd get two adjoining motel rooms, and we had it kind of set up so that each couple got the single room alone for one night to have sex in. Except Heather and I were not going to have sex because she was just Catholic enough that it was definitely not going to happen. Makeouts, really fantastic makeouts, but no sex. Heather was also just Catholic enough that she now has five or six kids with the dude that she dated immediately after me. They got married and then presumably had sex. And now they live in somewhere... like Cornhole, Pennsylvania or something. The most ungenerous version of me thinks that I dodged a bullet there. But the reality is this. I'm single. I live in Hot Dogs, Illinois. And I sleep in a windowless room in a dilapidated cinder block building. So there's that. Back in 1994, the day of the night that Heather and I were going to have the solo room, we spend the afternoon record shopping, which is a little boring for me because I'm too broke to like even buy tapes from the cutout bin. And I have this thing, which is still true today, where I feel like pretty uncomfortable hanging out in a shop, like in a retail establishment, when I'm totally sure I'm not going to buy anything. So that afternoon, I'm mostly alone, smoking cigarettes outside of Cleveland record stores, or alone listening to the radio in Heather's car. And at the last of these stops, the radio announces that Kurt Cobain had died. And it's kind of like jumping off the rope swing, but landing real funny, and your lungs feel inside out. And nowadays, it's hard to truly remember the enormity of that feeling, and even harder to remember like precisely what made it feel like so much. But it was a really big deal then. And also, one of the things that I am super good at, even to this day, is feeling sad. And I assume I was probably even better at it back then. So when the radio guy announced that they had found Cobain's body, I was pretty messed up about it. Moment later, all my pals pour out of the record store. They're laughing and goofing, and they look like these gorgeous, strange, weirdo punk angels, and I adore them so much that I decide I'm not going to tell them. I flick off the radio, I suck the news into myself. I'm not going to be the one to ruin spring break for everyone. Heather says, let's have a smoke and listen to this before we head back to the motel. She passes me a tape called Transmissions from the Satellite Heart by the Flaming Lips. And it's weird and brilliant, and we turn it up and smoke cigarettes outside the car. The whole time I'm fantastically sick at heart, keeping this horrible news from all these cats that I love. We return to the motel, we hang for a while. Heather and I kiss and listen to Transmissions from the Satellite Heart over and over again all night. And I feel just awful. I don't even remember when or how my pals found out about Cobain, but that feeling, that like unsettled sense of wanting to protect, of wanting to keep the trouble in the world at bay from the people I care about, even if that meant fibbing or faking it, that feeling's still super vivid. That time, the grunge era, was a crazy time in underground music. Nirvana was a tremendous commercial success, so all the major labels were poking around in the underground for other potentials, while deals were getting cut. And this little band from Norman, Oklahoma, got swept into it, getting signed by Warner Brothers Records to a multi-album deal. The Flaming Lips get signed in like 92 or 93, and from every moment since then, they have better than any other group of musicians in all of human history. They have done a remarkable job spending ludicrous amounts of money doing ludicrous things. And I mean that as like a huge, huge compliment. The animal suits, hundreds of thousands of gallons of fake blood, 1.7 million Christmas lights, a release that required four CD players running simultaneously to listen to it, the giant hamster ball, the cleaning bill for Wayne Coyne suits, the confetti, and time spent in the studio. Time well spent in the studio. A few years on, they record the Soft Bulletin. It is an unbelievably textured, crafted, immaculately constructed record. The band spent nearly 2 years recording it. That's like a Beatles or a Stones move. I mean, nowadays, bands measure studio time in days, occasionally months, but never years. And for the Soft Bulletin, it was worth every dollar and day spent. The record sounds incredible and really unlike anything else happening at that time.
Dangerous, but they're determined.
the microscope star. Hope against hope, forging for the future, but to sacrifice their lives. But it's so dangerous. They're determined. Theirs is to win. It will kill them. They're just humans with wives and children.
Due to the heroic efforts of a good friend, I'd like to recognize now Brian Thomas. It took until I was 20 to really start exploring what I at the time thought of as contemporary rock. In the summer of 2001, my most important records were this sort of usual starter kit at the time. OK Computer, Summer Teeth, I Can Hear the Heart Beating as One, some Bjork, some Seeing Cake, and The Soft Bulletin by the Flaming Lips. When I showed up on a Tuesday that fall for the first day of my senior year at DePaul, I found out school was closed because of a plane crash in New York, and nerd that I was fairly disappointed. I went back to my apartment, turned on the TV, and proceeded to watch it for about the next 15 hours, breaking only to make frantic long-distance phone calls to my best friend at NYU. When I finally went to sleep and woke up again, I put the Soft Bulletin CD that Brian had lent me in my Sony Discman and barely took it out until I had gone through about three sets of batteries. For the next several months, the world seemed to lose all of its complexity and nuance and enter an almost mythological level of clarity, where crude dichotomies like black and white, life and death, good versus evil, us versus them, Christian versus Muslim, became the standard operating procedure. Meanwhile, Wayne Coyne's faltering yet confident howl kept me company with the kind of bold sentiment that indulges in the same high-stakes realms of tragedy and violence versus bravery and love. Scientists don't just make progress, they race to save mankind. And though they were sad, they rescue everyone. The sun gets lifted into the sky. Love and light look like they could triumph, but the battle rages on. You've got a gash in your leg. I'm bleeding from the head. There are car crashes and fatal spider bites. Death and disaster wait around every corner. So we worry. We wait. We ask questions. What is this that struck me? What kind of weapons have they got? Is it overwhelming to use a crane to crush a fly? Will the fight for our sanity be the fight of our lives? What is the light shining all around you? Is it chemically derived? Have you lost all your will to battle on? Is it getting heavy? And like some smacked-out Richard Wagner, Steve Drozd manages the whole time to have his slightly off-kilter orchestra swell during the most poignant question every time, making the whole opera that much more stark and dramatic. And when the orchestra isn't epic enough, he unleashes drumming brutally bombastic enough for three John Bonhams. What else besides maybe Outkast's delightful and durable Bombs Over Baghdad could be as cathartic a soundtrack to the grief and subsequent slow-motion tragic farce of that time? The following summer would see the Lips release a more self-consciously conceptual album, also dealing with the decision to fight, to defend, to go to war. It would see a chart-puncturing single chock-full of life affirmations and death confrontations put forth in the form of questions about whether I realized certain things. And it wouldn't provide quite the same random violent disasters to be coped with or noble life-saving heroics to be cheered on. But most of all, it just wasn't heavy. Or if it was, it wasn't heavy enough. It wasn't too heavy. At least, it didn't match the heaviness of the moment the way the Soft Bulletin did when I needed it to.
question. I didn't need you to reply. Is it getting heavy? But then I realized, is it getting heavy? Well, I thought it was already as big as can be. Is it overwhelming to use a crane to crush a fly? It's a good time for Superman to lift the sun into the sky. Is it getting heavy? Well, I thought it was already as heavy as can be. That they should try to hold on best they can. He hasn't dropped them, forgot them, or anything. It's just too heavy for Superman to live.
So something else happens in and around the time that the soft bulletin is made. And for me, it's complicated. Wayne Coyne, this weirdo guy that sings in a rock and roll band, starts to present as Wayne Coyne, the acid-drenched Mary Poppins, Wayne Coyne, the bloody unicorn, Wayne Coyne, the Mad Hatter, the space guru, the bubblegum wizard of Fever Dream Oz. And let's be clear here, I'm going to say Wayne Coyne, and I'm not talking about the human being, I'm talking about the persona, the presentation, the implicit narrator of Flaming Lips songs, the being that we see on the stage. So don't be like, bro, I know Wayne, and he's totally not like that, because I don't like it when you call me bro. And also, I'm talking about the construct Wayne Coyne, who in this case is in fact being performed by a person inconveniently also named Wayne Coyne. So anyway, I'm not sure that I trust Wayne Coyne. There's a kind of fundamental optimism in his worldview that sometimes reads more like naivete to me. Don't get me wrong, there's often melancholic strains of sadness, brief conversations with the bleak in these songs. But hope always wins out for Wayne Coyne. And he spends a lot of time and a lot of Warner Brothers money trying to convince us of the veracity of this worldview. And when it works, in a song like Race for the Prize or in a song like Waiting for Superman, it's unbelievably lovely and fantastically compelling. But when it doesn't work, it makes me feel a little funny. And so we're going to play one of those.
Yeah.
I think I'm ready. I don't know what knobs to turn on this one. I'll just go for it. During the recording of the Soft Bulletin, Flaming Lips drummer and arranger and musical genius Stephen Drodes was shooting a lot of heroin, dangerous amounts of heroin. It almost killed him. The Spider Bite song is Wayne Coyne's response to that moment. And I sort of get it, keeping the danger of that scene at bay by filtering it through this childlike kaleidoscope. But something about it also makes me feel kind of funny. I don't know, it's complicated. I think that I wish I could live in the kind of world that Wayne Coyne is championing, the kind of world that he's spending money trying to actually make. His is a good world, full of curiosity and warmth. But I think I'm a touch too cynical. It's a noble endeavor. He's evangelizing. This better world is beautiful. I admire it. I wish for it. But for me, it's a little complicated. I can't quite buy in. And I guess I think that clearly Wayne Coyne has been up the mountain, and Wayne Coyne has stared into the impossible void, taking the terror and cruelty and emptiness into himself. And when he comes down the mountain, and his pals are like, "Hey, how is the mountain?" he smiles at them and decides not to ruin spring break for everybody. Thanks.
Look at you two thoughtful, talented individuals. We're changing all of that shit right now. Let's do this. Josh, you're good. You got any shows to plug?
No. Good. Oh, yeah, I do. A band that I play called Quarter Mile Flint is playing at Schubert's on Wednesday. Week from today.
That would have been so hard to remember. It's only a week from today down the street. Good job. Thank you so much for doing this. I've known you for roughly 10 years. True. Time flies, guys. Am I right? Am I right, guys? It flies! All right, this is what's going to happen. Annie, who also goes by the name Rock Falls, is going to play two songs from Nick Cave album. I will talk about said album. Unlike the people that performed before me, I have no talent. She has a ton of talent. She will demand respect and will earn it. You should start setting up now. I'm going to talk while you set up, because if I have to pause for 5 minutes, I'm going to lose the entire room, and I'm realistic and know that. Okay, I know I'm talking off a mic. We're going to use some visual aids for my bits. Okay, so I'm putting up the lyrics to the first 6 songs off of Nick Cave's And the Bad Seas, Dig, Lazarus, Dig. I'll explain why later. I lied. It's only the first 5 songs. Get that up there. Earlier this evening, Emerson brought up a very valuable point. That's that the only thing in life is like truth and beauty. Is that roughly the fairest thing to say? Like there's really no definites. We're just here to try to survive and live.
Yeah, more or less.
You're wrong. The only definite is that Weezer's new album is the album of the year, according to NPR Music. That's a fact, ladies and gentlemen. Let's put this up here. See, guys, there are definites in life. And all that other shit, that's bullshit. I don't got time for that shit because I like pussy. Here's why, guys. This shit matters. It's the only shit that does matter. Dig Lagers Dig is the record by a band. It's their 14th record. Most of them are from Australia. One guy's from America, so they're not all technically in the Australian Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but their only thing in there are didgeridoos and kangaroos, so who gives a shit? I'm insulting the country they're from. That's what I'm doing. My name is Brandon Weatherby. I should have said that earlier. Okay. I was supposed to have a podium and or a dais. I don't. That's why I wore a vest that is slightly too small for me. Hold on a second. This is important. I'm just joshing, guys. I just want you to have a good, fun time. No, that's way too small. I want a very tall podium. I want to have to stand on something. Anyways, look at that. Isn't that fucking cute? God damn it, that's cute. Okay, so this is a record from a band you already know or hate them. Nick Cave, blah, blah, blah. Who gives a shit? Here's the things you need to know about Nick Cave if you have no idea. He's the guy that could wear the mustache and not look rapey. He's one of those like 8 guys in the world that can pull that shit off. Number 2, you really wouldn't care if your wife slept with him, but he's a cool bro. Probably not a guy you'd actually want to hang out with. He seems like a miserable cunt. We'll get to that, and I mean that in the most gender derogatory way possible. Remember, this album is about pussy. We'll get to that in a second. Okay, so it's called Dig Lazarus Dig. Lazarus was the only one besides JC. Jesus Christ, everybody. Give it up for JC. Put your hands together. Seriously, put your hands together. Let's just think about that for a second. Okay, so he's the other guy that got raised from the dead, but he didn't have a say. So here's an album about him, and there's no one really else that wrote about Lazarus, he's a cool bro. His name is Lazarus. He did some stuff. Maybe not. I don't know. It's a fucking record. Who gives a shit? It sounds cool. It's important. Here we go. All right. Nick Cave, I was going to shave like Nick Cave. I'm not going to do that. Just because he's a cool guy that's shaving, I look like a dad. I can't not look like a dad when I shave, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do my best to read as few lyrics as possible. Now, Emerson read it earlier. Did it in a lovely way. You've already heard me talk. You don't want Nick Cave's words like through this. Here we go. Here's some of those words. But what do we know of the dead and who actually cares? Well, I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs. That's fun, guys. It's like when they bowl upstairs in heaven and that's when thunder and lightning come down. That's what he's saying. He likes the... It starts with an attack. It's a relatively short element. It starts with an attack, challenging God. Why did you do this to a man that did not request to be done this? And the last line of the song isn't to dig Lazarus, dig, like get out of the hole. It's to get back into the hole. Guys, he just wants to die again. It's a fun romp. I know we're talking about the record and not the videos of the record, but there is a video for this record, incredibly low budget in a great way, and he's kind of doing a walk thing. He's kind of looking like Mick Jagger, but he has the confidence that Mick Jagger never had because he's got good lyrics, so he doesn't have to like bend down. He just stands and walks. I'm going to fuck pussy. We'll get to that in a second. That's a big part of this record. Really misogynistic. I do not care if you don't like it. I get it. We're all different bros. Everybody, buy Cameron Esposito's new record. I highly recommend it. Okay. This is their 14th record. We've already gone over that. This was recorded very quickly, unlike all the other said records. You know why? They've been a band forever. They don't need fucking time in the studio. They got dicks. They got to use them on the record, and they do, a good job with it. I'm proud of these guys. It's the first Bad Seeds record where Nick Cave actually plays guitar for the majority of it. That's because of his band Grinderman, which this is between the only two Grinderman albums. The first Grinderman album, the single is No Pussy Blues, guys. We're still on the pussy bandwagon. Get on it. It's a fun bandwagon. By the way, you don't got to be a lady or a bro to like pussy, man. You don't even have to like pussy to like pussy. Everyone's cool. Warren Ellis, that's the guy that looks like he's homeless. He's in the band. This is the first record where he doesn't play violin. He kind of plays violin, but it's not like, oh, I'm sad, piece of shit. He plays it like a fucking, I don't know, mandolin or some shit. Who gives a shit? It doesn't matter. It sounds cool. Next song. So that was track one. I have the worst voice. That is such an annoying voice. I'll kill myself. All right, today's lesson is the... second track on the album, and I did a lot of research on this one. I did a lot of research on the when we did Beck's Mutations. Is that the one we did? I think we did Beck's Mutations. I don't remember. Ugh, Scientology, am I right? Ah, it's a religion. So we did this for Beck, and every single album review referenced the album Odelay. So the song's Where It's At or Two Turntables and a Microphone. 15 out of 15 reviews. This one, not so much. These journalists actually did a very good job with Nick Cave, except Chicago's very own. But let's start with a Pitchfork interview from circa 2008. It's a very good one. This is from Nick Cave. Once I wrote today's lessons, things started coming lyrically that seemed interesting. It got the heart beating, so to speak, and sort of showed the way forward with this particular record. And I would completely agree. Nick Cave is a very graphic man. Here we go, guys. Mr. Sandman has a certain appetite for Janie and Repose. He digs her pretty knees, and then she is completely naked underneath her clothes. Here's why. That's a funny line, guys. We're all naked under our clothes. You get it? Funny guy. And then he has sex with her pussy. So that was the second song on the record. Third song on the record is Moonland, and this amazing musician is going to perform it later. And we're going to actually close the show with that. And it's kind of like a Fiona Apple song to me. That's not a knock. I love Fiona Apple. I was listening to both today, and it makes sense. It's sad. And it's just how the line that you just that sticks in your head is, I'm not your favorite lover. The sad part is the Fiona Apple, when she sings a line like that, you're like, oh, Fiona, I'm so sorry. No, you're probably like pining. And Nick Cave's like, I'm having sex with another pussy. I don't care. Bam! Nick Cave likes to fuck. All right, so that's track three. It is the kind of song that makes me want to just drink a lot and smoke a lot of cigarettes because I'm a cool bro, and that's how he is, and I like this guy! Night of the Lotus Eaters is the first song on the album that I kind of want to skip. Even though it is a fantastic song, it just is incredibly monotonous, sad, boring, but it's super important to the like entire context of the record. And it kind of reminds me of the first Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds songs that I ever remember listening to, and that was the song Red Right Hand,
which appeared on the Batman Forever soundtrack. Guys, give it up for Batman 3, the Val Kilmer Batman. He was a good Batman, underrated Batman. Val Kilmer is the one Batman you'd probably want to drink with. Think about that. Adam West is a goddamn weirdo. Michael Keaton's cool, but he's kind of a recluse. He lives in Wyoming, a little boring. Val Kilmer got fat. Fat guys are fun. Clooney's annoying. Do you really want to have to go to Italy every time you want to share a bottle of wine? Fuck that guy. The other one is not even American. Doesn't count. I don't give a fuck. Affleck's whatever. I kind of like Affleck. But he's not Batman yet! This is my favorite piece of journalism. Giant air quotes I found for this. Oh, this is from an episode of Sound Opinions. What? What? Ah! Sorry. What am I doing that? It's not Greg Kot, obviously. This is not Greg Kot. Greg Kot does not give me anything funny to say. We are here with the Mighty Bad Seeds. What an honor! Nick, you have literally lived three lifetimes by this point in your career. That's not how that word works! You're a published poet, playwright, novelist, been in one of the greatest punk bands of all time. No, they haven't! The Birthday Party is top 100 at best! The Birthday Party. Cult hero, singer, songwriter, you've had a hit with Kylie Minogue, you've been covered by Johnny Cash, and yet... Your last two albums with Grinder Man and the new Bad Seeds record are among the strongest you've ever given us. He's assuming that because he's already done good shit, he can't possibly still do good shit. He just insulted him in a paragraph long sucking his dick. How are you doing this at this point in your career, finding the inspiration to be so awesome? That's the question. How are you so awesome? His response was, Dear Goddess, his follow-up statement was, I'm a fan! And then he said, how am I not awesome? I don't do a lot of radio shows. We just work. We work hard. Nose to the grindstone. Nose in that pussy! Listen, guys, it's a fun trip on the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Right. All right, Albert Goes West. And the next song is Albert Goes West. This is a fucking rage. Yeah! I don't know if that's in context of Nick Cave. You could say it's a rager. It's an amazing song. How many people have I walked yet? Not enough. Okay, here we go. Does anybody go, what's that bar on like Irving and Ashland? Is it the two-way? Not the two-way. They have a Nick Cave, not Nick Cave, sorry. They have the, shit, I haven't lived here in 5 years. Why am I pulling up local bars right now? Long Room. They have a Tom Waits cover band at the Long Room every once in a while. And I've always wondered, why isn't there a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds cover band? They're kind of alike. They both have a giant storytelling-esque catalog that you can easily call from. But the difference is, Nick Cave songs, you hear all of his vocals very clearly. And he sings things that are very disgusting. And while they both sing about things like prostitution and sadness and the devil and huge alcohol problems, you have no idea what the fuck Tom Waits is saying if you don't want to know. So if you're in a bar and you hear a guy go, bah, 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 and you're like, oh, I'll have a drink. Whiskey's good. But if you hear Nick Cave's going, he sucked on every Volvo. Yeah, I don't. Maybe I've had too much. Maybe I should be with my wife and go to therapy and fucking try. Because this guy's going around the country sucking every Volvo and then putting a revolver out his mouth. I can't even get revenge on this Nick Cave character. He's putting his face everywhere in the pussy. Here's why all these are up. We've gone through the first five songs thus far. See this mark, you see this mark, you see this mark, you see that mark, you see that mark? Those are all about vagina. All of those lyrics are about pussy. This album, though it's called Dig Lazarus Dig, is about digging that... Okay, I'll move on. Stephanie, you want to watch the new Cat Williams special later? I'm so excited. Okay. By the way, Cat Williams is the guy that got me into Nick Cave. Okay, moving on. We Call Upon the Author is, I think, the pinnacle of the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds catalog, if not Nick Cave's entire work. It is so fucking, I want to say tight, but that is so mean. Nick Cave song is tight. This is one of the very few pop songs that had me consulting a dictionary to look up certain words in the song, and I do not feel bad about that. This is one of those songs where you could kind of tell that it was recorded quickly, and it's also one of the songs you can tell that Nick Cave actually records the vocals with the band. This is pretty much the opposite of the Flaming Lips. There is not a lot of production time whatsoever, and it shows because there's an aside verse in this where he shouts out to his friend Doug tapping on the window, and Doug brings him a book on Holocaust poetry complete with pictures and then tells me to get ready for the rain, and we call upon the author to explain. That's brilliant. That is better than anything else. And it's, oh, God, that's so good. And I really want to know if there was just a guy named Doug walking by that has like a book of poetry, because in Nick Cave's world, that could really happen. Here's another reason why I love this song so much, specifically as someone that used to work in bars. Bukowski was a jerk. Berryman was the best. He wrote like wet paper mache, but he went the Hemingway weirdly on wings and with maximum pain. Fuck Bukowski! I've been saying that for years and no one will get on board with me except Nick Cave. By the way, I would like to appreciate everyone that did not leave when I said pussy 40 times and then clapped for Bukowski being the asshole. So thank you. You are with me. This song works and it sticks in your head. In addition to just being like you, if you heard this at a party, a well-curated party, it would make sense. You could put this in nearly any loud setting and it would fit. And it's fucking dark, but you could easily ignore it. And he's shouting at God or the lack thereof. Well, Nick Cave says he believes in God, and I believe that he believes in blah, blah, blah. That doesn't matter, though. You don't have to believe to enjoy this song. And that's why it's so good, because you can't imagine future sadness the same way. That's aging. He's yelling about aging and yelling about God and using Holocaust poetry and saying Bukowski was a jerk. That is brilliant. I'm staring at an electronic store across the street. I apologize. It was supposed to be a deep moment, but I just got completely sidetracked. Listen to that song. It's a good track. Check it out on iTunes, everybody. Okay, the next song, Hold On To Yourself. This is just another classic Nick Cave song, but this is how I imagine that they record this song. Nick Cave goes to the Batsies, "Hey, Batsies!" And that's how he talks in my head. And the Batsy goes, "Yeah, Nick!" And they go, "Can you play something mid-tempo with no beginning or end that sounds like the ocean sobbing?" And they're like, "Okay." And that's how that song exists. So that was pretty cool. That was that one. There's the one line in that that always sticks in my head is because Jesus only loves a man who bruises. What does that even mean, guys? What does it mean? Records are things you put on a table and they spin. You could buy them here. Check it out at sakirecords.org. Okay. Lie Down Here and Be My Girl. This is one of the most obsessive, scary visual verses on the album. One day I'll buy a factory. I'll assemble you down a production line. I'll build a million of you, baby. And every single one of them will be mine. That is scary, or the entire thesis of Nicki Minaj's career. So it's one of the two. I love it. And now let's get to the actual reason why you're here is for the delightful Rockfall. She's going to perform Jesus of the Moon. Please, please get up here. I need you up here, Jesus Christ. I need you up here 10 minutes ago. Where the fuck were you? That was JK. We're good. I don't think I just verbally abused you, did I? Oh, boy. I gotta watch that. I should step it up. Don't ever say that. Yeah, that's what the people want. They need a louder, more angry, manic man to talk about Nick Cave, someone who is, well, he's kind of angry, but not really. One of the things Cave does that a lot of performers his age don't realize is that he's always pretty much been well off. Not like rich, but he's been doing this for over 30 years, and he's 55, so it's kind of hard to complain about like the rent when you've been able to pay the rent since you've been in your mid-20s, and he stays away from that. If you talk about God and pussy, it's fine. Like, everybody gets God and pussy. I like saying pussy that way. Does that offend you as a person? Good. Fantastic. It does? Okay, here we go. In that same Sound Opinion interview, this is obviously the Greg Koch version, Cave talked about not trying to let religion get onto the album, and it obviously did, and that's a fantastic thing. It's used like anything else. He mixes the sacred and the profane, the light and the dark, the sad and the funny. It's not one-sided. And I'm going to get off the stage. Will you play Jesus of the Moon?
I stepped out of the St. James Hotel and I left you behind, curled up like a child. A change is gonna come as the door whispered shut. I walked on down the high-windowed hall. You lay sleeping on the unmade bed. The weatherman on the television in the St. James Hotel said that the rains are gonna come. And I stepped out on the streets, all sparkling clean in the early morning dew. Maybe it was you, maybe it was me, but it came on like a punch in the heart. You lie in there with all the light in your hair, like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars. Well, I kept thinking about what the weatherman said, and if the voices of the living can be heard by the dead, well, a day's gonna come when we find out, and in some kind of way I take a little comfort from that, 'cause people often talk about being scared of change. For me, I'm more afraid of things staying the same, 'cause the game is never won by standing in any one place for too long. Maybe it was you, maybe it was me. There's a chord in you I could not find to strike. You lie in there with all the light in your hair, like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars. I see the many girls walking down the empty streets, maybe once or twice. One of them smiles at me, really. You can't blame anyone for saying hello. I say hey, I say hello, hello. Will it be me or will it be you? One must stay and one must depart. You lie in there in the St. James Hotel bed, like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars. I say hello.
It was really, really good. I should try harder. Okay.
You kind of sound like PJ Harvey.
Uh-oh.
No, it's
she's
a good. I think that's a compliment.
Album.
I think that's a compliment. She's not on this album.
Yeah, she is. She sings a song with him on this album.
I thought it's a different album.
I'm pretty sure it's this one.
Let's not look it up. Okay.
Okay.
You're fantastic. Thank you for doing that.
You're fantastic.
Don't say that. Second to last song is Midnight Man. This is an incredibly well-sequenced album. It doesn't have like a loud side and a soft side. It actually goes up and down, kind of like life, guys. Midnight Man is another loud one, thankfully. And this is an interview from Music OMH, circa 2008. And I think it's the main reason why I like Nick Cave and guys like Nick Cave. I'm sort of the person, I don't know why this is, who has a compulsive need to start a new project of some sort. It means the world to start this new record, and I'm very good at pursuing an idea and finishing it. I don't get halfway through. I never have. I'm very single-minded about my pursuit of that idea. Once it's finished, I have absolutely no more interest in it, and I start the next thing. And it's amazing, and I completely think that's wonderful, and it fucking sucks because he's not playing any of these songs on the new tour. The new record by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, which is available at Saki Records, it's currently at the register, is 9 songs, and it's kind of one note. It's kind of sad. It's kind of about the sea. And that's it. It's a perfectly fine record. It's probably a 6 out of 10, where I'd say this is like a 9 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10. And the last song on the track is More News From Nowhere, and it's a very, very good way to end the album because it doesn't really sound like an album closer, but it is an album closer. Obviously, it is the album closer, but it's 7 minutes and 58 seconds, which is a pretty long song, and if you put this anywhere else on the record, you're probably not going to finish it, at least the second time through. And the last line is goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. It's the fucking album closer. It's perfect. And here's the thing that's really neat that I didn't notice, at least the first 10 listens. He references one of his most well-known songs. I bump and crash into Deanna, hanging pretty in the doorframe. All the horrors that have befallen me. Well, Deanna is to blame. He's blaming a woman, guys. Guess who likes Hemingway? Anyways, my first knowledge of Nick Cave, not Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, but Nick Cave, was thanks to a Spin magazine cartoon. The last page of the monthly magazine used to feature a cartoon based on an antidote, probably a lie, of someone that's famous. And the Nick Cave cartoon was about a teenage Nick Cave trying to impress a teenage girl by breaking and entering into strangers' houses, and they stumbled upon a dead body. I have no idea if this is true. I have no idea if this is going to exist if I made this up, because I just kept listening to the Batman Forever soundtrack. And I thought that'd be a cool thing. But it doesn't really matter, because all throughout high school, I just wanted that to happen to me and my girlfriend more than ever, because then that's real love. If you find a body and you're a teen and you're together, that's love, guys. Yeah, I'm married. We're not soulmates. Those don't exist. But true love, that's fine when you're about two teens finding a dead body. There's a brand new Nick Cave doc. I'm afraid to see it. I don't really want to know how this guy like eats food. I can't imagine Nick Cave eating food. That's a weird thing to me. I don't want to imagine this guy even owning a t-shirt or pajamas. Fuck that. No. He just wakes up in a suit that's like half disheveled, and then he never really completes the look, but that's the look, so it's kind of perfect. Like, how does he pay rent? Does Nick Cave pay the gas bill? I assume he's just a fire at all, no matter what temperature there's a fireplace. Maybe he eats occasionally. I know he did a lot of drugs for a long time, but he's fine. He's still rail thin. Maybe it's an IV. He lives in an IV on an island with no plumbing. Guys, have you seen Buying Alaska? It's a show on... You should watch Buying Alaska. It's fucked up. You don't have to live in Alaska, guys. I don't know if people in Alaska know that. You can move. So yeah, pretty much tying Buying Alaska to Nick Cave was the right thing to do in both this crowd and in life. I think I'm the first and only and last person to ever do that, because I'm the best. Here's why I'm the best. Because I'm friends with her. Okay? Can't hate me. You gotta like her. Now you don't hate me as much. Or you hate me even more because I'm preventing you from her, and I get that. We're going to backtrack a little. And this is the third time doing this, and she and I have been the constants on this, and she's always a highlight. And we decided to close with music because it makes a hell of a lot more sense than me talking about Buying Alaska. Watch Buying Alaska. You will not. It's so fascinating. I don't know why I like it. Also, Pit Bulls and Parolees. Your heart will fucking break. I was in tears before a show the other night. They're trying so hard. Anyways, you're going to play Moonland? Ladies and gentlemen, one last time, please put your hands together for Rock Falls.
When I came up from the meat locker, the city was gone. And the sky was full of lights. The snow provides a silent cover in Moonland. Under the stars, under the snow. And I followed this car. And I followed that car through the sand, through the snow. And I turn on the radio and listen to the DJ. And it must feel nice. It must feel nice to know that somebody needs you, and everything moves slow under the stars and the ash through the sand, and the night drifts in. The snow provides a silent cover. I'm not your favorite lover. I turn on the radio. And it must feel nice. It's very, very nice to know that somebody needs you. The chilly wind blows under the snow, under the stars. The whispering DJ on the radio, the whispering DJ on the radio. And I'm not your favorite lover. I'm not your favorite lover, and it must feel nice to leave no trace at all. But somebody needs you, and that somebody is me. Under the stars, under the snow, your eyes were closed. You were playing with the buttons on your coat in the back of that car. That car
You're so very good, and I know you.